Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Once again, back video streaming for our YouTube and Rumble and Odyssey channels and GaryKnoll.com and PRN.live. I've been away for the last 3 weeks, and as many of you know, I was leading an anti-aging clinical study, number 6. The results will be known in about 4 months. But the on-campus part, the difficult part, is behind us now. Then I went, same day that I finished, up to Kingston, New York, along with Gerald Salante and others, to lead a demonstration on how to make America healthy again. Unfortunately, we're not as healthy as we once were or should be. In fact, our lifespan has declined over the past 3.5 years by almost 5 years for the New York residents, but also about 3 years or a little more for the rest of the country. How do we get that back? How do we get healthy again? Well, I want to thank the thousands of you who showed up for that rally. Again, it was a long trip up. I promise you, no more trips to Kingston. Any rally we're going to do right in New York City, where we've historically done them. But then I went to Woodstock and premiered to a private group a screening of my new documentary, and it was well received. And again, I was happy to be able to share that energy with you. And to the Running and Walking Club members who've done marathons with me in the past, the oldest, I believe, was Ruth. 40 years ago, she did her first marathon. Still looks terrific, great shape, but all the other people also were in good shape. And it was just a wonderful 3 hours we spent together in Central Park. Now I'm back at my animal sanctuary, where I rescue animals, bring them back to health, like love, and find them a home for life. And whew, I did a long exhale. So today we're going to begin our program with the latest, as we always do, on health and healing. Remember, all the information I'm sharing with you comes from the National Library of Medicine, is peer-reviewed, and is considered the repository of the finest quality science available. For example, from Western New England University, new evidence shows that grapes have a positive impact. Not on our heart, we knew that. As an antioxidant, we knew that. And also the particular chemical ingredient, the phytonutrient in there, resveratrol, we really need that. Now, this is about your gut bacteria. According to the study, if you like grapes and you get them fresh and even frozen, they end up causing positive bacteria in your gut. So there's a direct link between good bacteria from grapes and good bacteria in the gut, and then your metabolism responds to that in a positive way. So if you want a better metabolism, and who doesn't, then make sure you're having some fresh organic grapes wherever possible, because the phytonutrients in there help the what is called the biome in the gut to your favor. From National Taiwan University, garlic compounds may boost cardio health indirectly via, the gut microbiota. It's called allicin, A-L-L-I-C-I-N, and it's from garlic, and it can help prevent the metabolism of unabsorbed carnitine or choline into TMAO, a compound linked to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, so said the newest study. So what we want is we want healthy nutrient absorption, and garlic helps us do exactly that. So have yourself some garlic, ideally some liquid garlic. There are firms making organic liquid garlic. 1 teaspoon a day helps keep your blood pressure down, helps keep the bad cholesterol down, helps kill bacteria and viruses you don't want in your throat, even gargling with a little and swallowing it. Especially if you find yourself around people who have a cold or flu and you don't want to get those. That'll help. I know before I went on, I did a lot of flying. I mean, long trips in the last 3 weeks. But before I'd get on a plane, I would take a little liquid, a 3-ounce liquid, and I'd squirt about 1 ounce into the back of the throat and gargle for about 60 seconds. That kills a lot of bacteria. Then I would spray colloidal silver into my nostrils. That kills bacteria, but also prevents additional bacteria from getting in. I would then take some vitamin D3 about 3,000, 5,000 units, zinc, about 50 milligrams, and vitamin C, about 1,000 milligrams, and quercetin, 1,000 milligrams. And all that working together keeps your immune system strong. I would sit there in my seat, and then I'd pump my feet because that increases circulation to the extremities. So you get more oxygen and blood flowing from the heart through the arteries down, circulating back through the veins. And just by sitting there and moving your legs, feet, you know, push your toes as far forward as you can, then back as far as you can, that's creating a contraction and releasing, contraction and releasing. That pumps blood. If you're like the average person, cross your legs. Never cross your legs while you're sitting. It's very dangerous because you're blocking the blood flow. Also, sitting at a desk is not healthy for more than like an hour and a half, 2 hours max. The same in a car, truck, cab, or in any environment. Get up and walk. You need that circulation. So then I wear a plastic shield over my entire face. And then I have a couple ionizers here that throw out ions, and then that traps different airborne particulate matter and neutralizes them. I wear gloves, and I may look a little different than everyone else, but then again, I've never been sick. Big difference. So just think of it this way. Think of how many times you touch dollars, doorknobs, handles, things that other people have touched. Without thinking, what if that person sneezed or coughed in their hands and then touched that? Whatever's in their body is now in yours. That's why I never eat salads or raw foods in any restaurant. I don't care what the reputation of the restaurant is. I've owned 3 very successful restaurants. The first gourmet vegan restaurant in American history, The Fertile Earth, 1970 to 1980, up on 108th and Broadway, and then Gary's Place, and Gary's Place, Dover in Columbus. And I saw, even with the strictest of oversight, people sometimes forget to wash something properly, or if you're really busy, they wash it superficially. And sometimes, in some restaurants I've seen, they don't wash it at all. In fact, I went into a health food store when I was on this trip, just wanting a glass of juice. So I'm watching. Okay, they had gloves on. Good. And then they took carrots right out of a bag and started to juice them. And I said, hold on a second. Is that what you normally do? Yeah, they're organic. I said, so is your feces. All right, would you play with your feces and then go make a salad? Well, no. There are times when I wonder how irresponsible we are when it comes to personal hygiene. So when I suggest they wash them thoroughly, or better still, scrape the outer skin, wash them, juice them. And I said, when was the last time you cleaned the juice extractor? Well, when it gets clogged, that means that everything was unwashed, all the bacteria in there. I don't think people realize how common food poisoning is. It's rampant. And because we trust that whatever's served, beautifully served, is healthy or is disease-free or microbe-free, not the case. You know, this article about garlic is in the Journal of Functional Foods. Again, garlic is just one of the best things you can take into your system. And it really helps clear up mucus in the throat, and it also helps your immune system. Do you remember the song, Don't Worry, Be Happy? Well, what if I told you it's not that simple? According to the University of Buffalo, happiness is something to work on towards a goal and accumulate over time. That's what we're told. Or is it something transient and fleeting that should be savored in the moment? What if both are right or both are wrong? Past research has examined who, when, and why some people favor feeling happy now versus later. But those studies don't address how this preference for immediate versus delayed happiness relates to behavior and well-being. Now, University of Buffalo psychologist is filling that gap with a study that approaches happiness from a novel research angle. The findings are published in the journal Emotion, and they suggest that people's beliefs about happiness matter in shaping their everyday goal and their pursuits and their well-being. So what you perceive can be happy then becomes the goal you go through. Now, over the weekend, I had a chance to see a film that's out now and had a big premiere and probably was pretty successful. And it's all about where we're at now in our lives. And there was one scene, just one scene in this movie, that showed some people washing clothes and having fun doing it. Well, part of that reason that they were having fun doing it and were happy is because that's how they related socially. That's how they created bonds, much like monkeys, of all primates of all kinds, from gorillas, gibbons, and I've worked with chimpanzees. I helped with Kokomo Jr. If you're old enough to remember the Dave Garraway show on NBC, then you'll remember that that little female adorable chimpanzee, turns out it was actually a male, was the one I worked with for almost 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, she could respond to over 160 different communications, but she also began to teach herself. And it was amazing to watch her. And I wrote a whole manuscript on this called From Instinct to Intellect, a Study of Primates. But part of that, part of the need of the primate is to bond. And then once you start bonding, like every time she saw me, she'd run up and jump up and grab me around the chest, and she'd just put her face right in mine, just give me kisses, kisses, kisses. It was adorable. And then we'd sit there, and she'd just make sure. Then she'd go up on my hair, and she'd start parting the hair and looking for whatever insects in nature they would have. But it's not just getting rid of ticks and fleas and lice and other things that a person or an animal could get. It's the bonding. And primates spend a lot of time either grooming themselves or bonding by grooming others. It's a whole ritual. And there's a happiness. There's an ease. There's no tension. In fact, when the two monkeys that I was raising that were abandoned by their mothers, one year apart, but both about 6 months old, they were so small I could put them both in the palm of my hand. I have pictures up on the internet. In fact, I have someone took a video of one of them is so small, and she's sitting on my shoulder, and I go over to a peach tree in my orchard, and I pick a peach, and she reaches out and grabs the peach, starts to eat the peach, just adorable. But then at the age of two, their hormones change. Now they're play fighting all day, every day. But if one gets a little too rough and hurts the other one a little bit, scratches, they'll immediately go over and bond and groom and hug. I mean, long hugs, like 10 minutes. So if you anticipate something being a positive experience, a pleasurable experience, then you're far more likely to have that experience. But what if you've never had those kind of relaxing, loving, happy feelings? Then you're less likely to recognize them or even know how to create them. Then we start getting into this cycle of my happiness is out there. I got to work hard. Now, family, here's what we're going to do. Your mother and I are both professionals. I'm a medical doctor. Your mom's a lawyer. Children, we're going to have to do some sacrificing now, but think of it this way. Every day your mother and I are furthering our careers, establishing the importance and significance and relevance of our presence. We're going to be, at some point, rewarded with greater income, more opportunities to become socially responsible. We'll be appointed to different boards. And all that means we're going to have a better standard of living for you. Okay. And then they go at it. How many go at it? Well, when you add in scientists, professors, architects, engineers, medical doctors, lawyers, judges, you're talking about 17 to 20 million Americans directly are in the upper educated social order of professionalism. Now, there are other professionals that are not as educated, and they're way down here, and we're very much a class society. So then you hear this, and how do I know this is real? Because with Dr. Elaine Kahn, who founded the Center for Marital Guidance, I handled the men, she handled the women, we both handled the couples. Thousands and thousands of stories we heard. Then in my own counseling of tens of thousands of people, and by extension in my health support groups, hundreds of thousands, in clinical studies, I've gotten a lot of feedback. I've got enough feedback from enough people and enough class and ethnicities and religions and relationships, single, married, divorced. get to know something. And if there's one group that is far happier in just being in their life and enjoying the people in it and enjoying the rituals of that, just like the women on that mountain who go up every Saturday and do their laundry, that you see them all coming up and they were all laughing. Someone would bring the picnic and they'd lay out the... And this was a Italian place that the Romans built, I should say, and that's where they went to do their wash. It was a fresh spring that came out, so the water was always clean. And there they'd be doing, you know, cleaning all the garments and holding it, putting them up on the... By the way, the lines in the summertime where you put your clothespin, do you ever notice how the dry clothes smell differently? There's this wonderful smell of nature in the clothes versus a washing machine, drying machine. Anyhow, there was just joy. They were sharing something that they anticipated would give them great joy and happiness, and it did. Cooking together, same thing. Going to church together, same thing. Rituals that today a lot of people think are just stupid or superstitious or non-essential, but they're very much essential. And so find happiness in the moment you're in. Don't wait till you achieve a certain standard of living before you say, now I can exhale and be happy. I've got everything. I got this and that and the cars. And the... No. Every single successful person, rich person, I'm talking about members of a royal family. I'm talking about multi-billionaires. I'm talking about the old-fashioned billionaires that didn't make it out of the stock market. And I had three of those billionaire friends. Not one of them was happy with what they had. They always thought that happiness was just one more goal achieved. And what they lose in the process? Their families, their friends, their health, and the meaning and purpose of their life. One of them came to that awareness at the end of life. One of them. And wow, one day I'll tell that story because it's one of the most remarkable stories I've ever participated in my life. Going from the pinnacle of success to living in a trailer in the desert, impoverished. And why? Too embarrassed to ask any of the friends for help, because this was the person everyone went to for help. Got the wrong values. Forgot what life was supposed to be about. Happiness is everyone's birthright. Look for happiness in the simple things. Look for it in the joy, the laughter, the humor. Look for it in the rituals of life. It's there. That's what this study is showing. Therefore, they're straight on. And finally today, 1 in 5 so-called healthy people actually have the metabolism of a pre-diabetic, and that's according to Click Laboratories in Ontario. Yes, 1 in 5 people may not be as healthy as they think. Scientists from Click Labs have developed a new way to detect early signs of type 2 diabetes before it's too late. Shockingly, they found that a fifth of so-called healthy people, according to medical standards, actually had the metabolism of someone who is dealing with prediabetes. So that's where a lot of people who work out in the gym, I got muscle. I don't have a belly. I have low body mass index, and I've got good muscle. Okay, that only means you're fit. It does not mean you're healthy. And that's a big difference, because there's several. You have to be fit and healthy and happy in order to have a healthy long life. So I see a lot of people who can't understand why they've got this raised blood sugar level. Was because their metabolism is not healthy. So always get yourself checked. Oh, and by the way, University of Navarra in Spain, extra virgin olive oil kills cancer cells in 1 hour, but only if the quality is high. Take the time wherever you're buying your olive oil. Check to see where it comes from. Make sure it's not one of the enormous amounts of olive oil coming out of Spain and Greece and Italy and France that is actually soy oil with a little bit of olive oil in it, because the organized crime has a lot of control over the olive oil. Check it. Make sure that the person importing it, whether Spectrum or Bragg, and these are high-quality oils, make sure they've done independent analysis of every shipment. That takes about $1,000. They can determine, is it real 100% organic, fresh pressed? If it isn't, don't buy it. And your cheap olive oils almost always run the risk of being adulterated. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Once again, I'm going to invite you to a classroom on the air, but this is going to be different than anything I've shared before. Historically, I've shared everything from how to raise your own food, hydroponics, orchards, how to freeze-dry foods, how to be healthy, how to exercise, how to de-stress, and all the different issues that I can think of that can make a person able to make choices to live a longer and healthier and happier life. This is a little different. I do not advocate for any political system or religious system. I believe that if you've chosen a body politic, if you've chosen a sexual identity, if you've chosen a religious belief or not, that's your business. And I respect that for you. What happens when we once were, for a period of time, exceptional? There were lots of times we were not exceptional, and then we lost our exceptionalism. How'd that happen? Because I remember, as a baby, when we're growing up, when nobody locked their doors. We didn't have ghettos. We didn't have starvation. We didn't have people living at death's door. We didn't have all the diseases, including obesity and depression and anxiety. Something happened. I'd like to share with Richard Gale and myself what we call America is no longer exceptional. But at one short time from 1940 to 1975, it was. And let's acknowledge what was and try to figure out what happened. We have moved well beyond the years when the myth of American exceptionalism should be have been abandoned. Yet this myth that we are exceptional persists despite the hysteria and chaos ripping the nation into unrecognizable shreds. America, in our opinion, is spiritually bankrupt. That is not to suggest, however, that there are not a lot of Americans who are spiritual, moral, ethical, and live by those principles. But more often than not, they are not the policymakers nor the opinion leaders. Quote, we suffer from a spiritual blackout. Who said that? That American philosopher and public intellectual Cornel West. According to West, the nation's spiritual blackout, quote, is characterized by a culture of superficiality where appearance matters more than substance, and people are more concerned with image and spectacle than with cultivating genuine relationships and meaningful connections. We have become a nation obsessed with trivial beliefs about freedom and individualism at the expense of higher virtues. We sit paralyzed on a precipice, incapable of restoring sanity to a regime built upon every contradictory propaganda, lies, and deception of media indoctrination. The tyranny and derangement of the country's collectivist ego has overthrown and usurped the democracy of the soul, a fear that did not go unnoticed by the Constitution's drafters. The nation's founders recognized the cruel issue of if we do not pay attention to crucial dangers that the loss of ethical and tolerant virtues posed to the preservation of functioning democracy, then we wouldn't have it. During his speech at the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin warned, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. How true that was then, how true even more so it is today. And in a letter to the Massachusetts militia in 1798, John Adams wrote, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Now, you could agree or disagree with that, but it's important we take a moment for deeper, more thoughtful introspection, not coming from our conditioned epigenetically manipulated minds, but rather coming from our clear conscious awareness that we are sentient beings and have far more in common with each other than we have divisiveness. We should not allow ourselves to be balkanized. We should not allow ourselves to be put into groups and fighting one another. We do not benefit from that, but others in power do. These voices should encourage us to pause and reflect just for a moment on how the country has become unmoored and now drifts aimlessly in an ocean of social turbulence, uncertainty, and moral emptiness. America had its moment of exceptionalism. That time has rapidly waned. For a growing number of developing nations, the old canards of John Winthrop's Shining City on a Hill, Abraham Lincoln's Hope of the World, and FDR's Beacon of Democracy. Today, they are hollow banalities. America is great because she is good, wrote Tocqueville. If America ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Nations, especially in Africa and Latin America, no longer regard Washington's foreign policy as a force for good. Last month, the number of countries that have applied for BRICS membership increased to 30. As the U.S. sends State Department and Pentagon officials to persuade African Gulf states and Asia leaders to turn away from China and Russia, they now return home empty-handed, aside from harsh reprimands about American hypocrisy, electoral interference, militaristic bullying, sanctions as an economic weapon, and unfair trade agreements and international bank loans, and unfair, undemocratic, and illegal regime changes. Within the new emerging multipolar world, the U.S., United Kingdom, and European Union, and its few remaining allies, seem guaranteed to be left in the cold if they continue with the nonsense of U.S.-based international order, supposed to be the World Economic Forum's best friend, when in fact the World Economic Forum and its allies are looking at dystopian aspirations, not freedom for you and I, and a better way of living and cooperating, communicating together. But the U.S. is not history's first exceptional nation or empire. During the 208-year heyday of Pax Romana, 27 BC to 180 AD, Rome, too, was perceived as the world's exceptional power. Similar to the United States, Rome's diversity allured foreigners throughout the empire, from Britannia, Hispania, Asia Minor, to Dalmatia, which is the modern Balkans, and beyond. People subservient to the harsher side of the Roman Empire sought citizenship in order to gain access to civil rights, legal protection, social acceptance, and greater opportunities for upward mobility. Other citizenship perks included public education, health care, welfare services, and grain security during times of food scarcity and famine. Yet the city of seven hills, the Urbs Eterna, were eternal cities. Exceptionalism was short-lasting. As several classical historians, notably Colin Murphy and Mary Bird, have observed, the parallels between the demise of Rome and the United States are very similar and completely striking. Military overextension, perverse war expenditure at the expense of domestic economic health, political instability due to corruption and power struggles, inflation and debt, erosion of civil institutions, and widespread moral decay in the pursuit of hedonic satisfaction rather than genuine well-being and social cohesion are all clear indications that the United States is following Rome's trajectory in the dustbin of failed experiments in democratic governance. Surely we witness these indicators of domestic and imperial decay plastered daily on our daily headlines and strangely exalted by mainstream media pundits, continuing the facade of American military superiority as a means to bully nations into compliance with U.S. interest, is no longer justified or accepted. At one time or another during the past six decades, the United States has supported every right-wing dictatorship. It doesn't matter who's in power, Democrat or Republican. And that's why we have to start thinking that one party or the other has the right information, the right prerogatives to lead us They do not. Upon receiving the Nobel Prize in 2005, a British playwright took the opportunity to rather brilliantly condemn the United States foreign policy. This you saw in no American publication. Unfortunately, actually, the United States has fared better than many of the nation's founders expected. In his recent book, Fears of the Setting Sun, Syracuse University historian Dennis Rasmussen presents America's founders' disillusionment and pessimism after the Constitution and the Republic, likely inability to preserve it. For Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, John Adams, the new constitutional experiment wouldn't last beyond a generation. However, rather than acknowledging the nation's decline and taking progressive corrective measures, the decay and rot in the system is glossed over with an abnormal hubris of progress, manicured in fictitious statistics of economic growth. Our exceptionalism in the world is carried to the point of comic absurdity to convince us that we are all better off today than yesterday. The recent debt ceiling crisis alone should have awakened the public to Washington's system of malignancy. The federal government's failures to lessen incurring national debt, now at $31.8 trillion, with $188 trillion in unfunded liabilities, has led to a crisis of bankrupting the Treasury, which would spin the nation into a very long recession. Unsurprisingly, the infinite lack of political wisdom in Washington has found its way to blame China and Putin and Russia for this financial crisis in order to deflect attention away from our leaders, elected leaders' repulsive ineptitude. Biden's recent debt ceiling bill is simply a game of duopoly, parties exchanging bargaining chips. The bill only provides more time to cut the deficit a measly $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years, while increasing the defense budget to $888 billion in order to further feed Washington's irrational obsession to weaken Russia and plan for a confrontation with China. Within this madness, federal programs for poor working families and jobless individuals are downsized. The qualification age for food stamps changed. Health coverage and income assistance within a working reporting requirement has been increased. And this is coupled with slave labor restrictions that would pay qualified persons $3.51 per hour, approximately on par with the minimum wage of Cambodia and Myanmar. The level of American illiteracy is astonishing. The average American lives in an astral garbage heap of superstitions, legends, political cliches, and meaningless slogans. This dark specter of media-controlled groupthink lingers over the heads of the misinformed. Following the warnings of social psychologist Leon Festinger in the 1950s, the American populace is being de-individualized. De-individualization is a state whereby individuals lose their sense of self-awareness and their realistic and healthy personal identity in order to become part of a crowd that opposes other crowds. And hence what we have today. Normal moral restraints are cast aside, and which we have lived with peacefully, cooperatively, for at least the last 60 years, and are being replaced by impulsive and deviant behavior. No tolerance, no freedom of expression, no civil conversation, no appreciating the uniqueness of the other person, their culture, their religion, their belief systems, all of which help us enhance our sense of awareness. Instead, we are imbued, soaked, saturated, and drowned in the entire woke narrative, giving way to antisocial behavior. The best way to inform a city of your anger is burn it down. But the people you don't like, beat them or kill them. And what does this give us? It gives us fear, which makes us easier to be controlled. These are not notable consequences of current deindividualization accelerating even in the halls of government and corporate boardrooms. This is the new mantra. Deindividualize a person, especially those who can think, who engage in critical dialogue, those who are not persuaded by consensus of the mob rule. And yet science has been taken over by scientism, those who come with a mindset that there is no such thing as innate healing, that everything is cause and effect. It's all molecular. It's all in the atoms and genes. Nothing approaching a spirit. Nothing approaching intuition. Nothing approaching the innate ability of people to recognize what is divine within themselves or others. No, trust no one, because we have shown we cannot be trusted, is their motto. But what about those of us who trust? And part of that trust is receiving trust in return, to give love unconditionally and receive in return, to be happy with who we are and not try to change others, but to accept them for who they are unless they want our help. De-individualization may reinforce illiteracy and blatant stupidity. Just go onto any college campus and ask them simple questions, and you'll find how in the world did this generation expect to support a future if they're this illiterate. When Democrats brought an executive for an abortion rights organization before the House Judiciary Committee to give testimony, this person claimed that men could get pregnant and have abortions. One Biden judicial nominee didn't even know several articles to the Constitution that were prerequisites for every federal judge, didn't know them. Another nominee for the Supreme Court, a Kendanji Brown Jackson, refused to give her definition of a woman because she said she's not a biologist. Given the observable decline in the nation's so-called intelligentsia, as the above examples just show, it is reasonable to predict that few Americans likely know about the Bill of Rights. In its two-year history of heated debates, contentious and numerous compromises and revisions between rival factions before the first Ten Commandments were ratified in 1791, the Bill of Rights, a cornerstone of American democracy, was designed to safeguard individual liberties and limit government power. Where do you see the government's power limited today? You see individual rights limited today. You see a form of apartheid occurring at the level in America, depending upon which party is in power and how they perceive any opposition. However, as society has evolved and now confronts unanticipated technological challenges in the 21st century, it becomes increasingly apparent that the Bill of Rights has serious shortcomings that undermine certain human rights and freedoms. The challenges posed by digital technologies and more complex societal issues reveal the need for a nuanced and adaptive approach to protect individual rights and freedoms while preserving the nation's fundamental principles. Without such reform, the Bill of Rights risks becoming an outdated fossil for safeguarding liberties. And why is it that we have multiple laws in the books, state laws, federal laws, and they're being abused, set aside, as if the Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our freedom of speech, our Fourth Amendment, undue risk of property being searched and seized, these have simply been abrogated to the junk heap of, those are no longer convenient, let's just get rid of them. With the arrival of the digital age, the First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of speech, press, assembly, and religious beliefs is imperiled in ways the nation's founders could never have predicted. Private tech corporations operating in collusion with federal intelligence agencies possess inordinate control over social media platforms and readily censor and suppress any narrative contrary to their agendas of population control and mind think. The concentration of power and the silencing of dissenting voices highlights the limitations of the Bill of Rights to protect free speech in the 21st century. The rapid development and deployment and infiltration of technology into every aspect of Americans' lives has fundamentally allured the landscape of private rights. It has allured it to the idea the rapid development and infiltration of technology into every aspect of Americans' lives has fundamentally altered the landscape of privacy rights. The Fourth Amendment, which was intended to protect against unwarranted searches and seizures, fails to sufficiently address the serious consequence of digital surveillance, mass data collection, and the invasion capabilities of modern technology. Without satisfactory and principled legal protections, widespread deployment of surveillance cameras, electronic monitoring, and the collection of your personal information by both the government and private corporations threatens your privacy. Nor is the United States' most revered document, the U.S. Constitution, as monolithic and everlasting in order to address the complexities of modern world life. For example, the Electoral College outlined in the Constitution dismally fails to represent the will of the people in a population of 332 million citizens. The democratic principle of one person, one vote is now completely undermined by the disproportionate allocation of electors that can override a majority vote. Think of the billionaires who decide the outcome of elections. And this is acceptable? It should not be. This discrepancy is clearly evident in recent elections, which has fueled demands for electoral reform to ensure elections are more accurately reflecting the votes of the people. In addition, the absence of congressional term limits horribly hinders the evolving need of the nation at a time of increased acceleration of technology and climate change and shifting global economic partnerships. Without term limits, entrenched incumbents prioritize their personal and partisan interests over the welfare of their constituents. This has resulted in senior legislators being captured by corporate interests for decades, both left and right. Consequently, our political arena has become ineffectively stagnant, with zero accountability and incapable of moving forward on critical reforms to stay abreast of domestic and international change. Likewise, as the country grapples with 21st century complexities, the Constitution's major points require careful ethical reevaluation by a new enlightened standard as a potential for reform. But sadly, no one in Washington reaches the caliber of integrity required to undertake such a moral assessment, free from the three modern poisons, greed, power, and influence. In an effort to offer up a progressive platform to rekindle a flame of a democratic renaissance in the United States, we proceed with caution. If history is any indicator of success, a progressive renaissance, in an effort to offer up a progressive platform to rekindle a flame of a democratic renaissance in the United States, we should proceed with caution. If history is an indicator of success, a progressive renaissance cannot rely solely on turning our gaze towards the past and what have been at one point a reality that today must be changed. That too has its own audacity and fuels the illiteracy built into the fabric of the worst forms of nationalism. Again, we are reminded of Jefferson's words, "Illiteracy is the enemy of progress and the ally of tyranny." Today, America qualifies, as Nelson Mandela's description, as a society in change. A citizenry now psychologically crippled for making informed decisions to participate thoughtfully in a democratic process. Consequently, a democratic renaissance can only proceed following a revitalization of moral and spiritual values that have universal appeal, a universal truth, not just your personal truth. And unfortunately, today we live by personal truths. I will take care of my child, but not care about yours. I want my freedom, but I'm not accepting yours. I want my freedom of speech, but I don't want to hear what you have to say. I want to be able to feel that I am safe in an environment, but I don't care if you feel safe as well. Why don't we look at universal truths where we care for each other in all countries, all backgrounds, and not separate ourselves by a class divide? This requires our elected leaders casting aside the pretentiousness and vanity of exceptionalism that has caused a growing percent of the world's population to hate us, even despise us. To be worthy of participating in any viable possibility for a real democracy in the 21st century, it is necessary to return to becoming John Adams' moral people. Thank you for watching. Share this. Welcome back, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that, or at least found some meaning, a different way of looking at reality. I'm going to be doing a commentary each day this week. I did 2.5 days of commentary last week on looking honestly and with scholarship of whether or not the vaccines are safe and effective. I published the article up on GaryNoll.com, Vaccines Are Safe and Effective, or Are They? Asking the hard questions. I'm going to end our show today. By the way, you can have a chance to call in and share any thoughts you'd like on this at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. My voice is a little strained because I've been doing an enormous amount of lecturing, not just on my radio and not just when I'm out of town, but I do a lot of webinars and discussions. In any case, a little background on what you're about to hear. Recently, I received a phone call by a person that I've known, well, since 1970. She hired me. She was the personal assistant of the director of the Institute of Applied Biology. I never saw her not working. A remarkable human being. Her name is Elena. And her mentor was at the Pasteur Institute, but because he was Jewish, he had to flee to the United States around 1942. And then he was at the Institute ever since. And I was allowed to do my own work. I turned in 165 completed, original, positive outcome scientific studies. And it was supposed to go through an internal review, discussions, challenges at the monthly meeting, and then go out for peer review publication. I never thought twice about it. She gives me a call and she says, I can't type it a letter I would because I'm paralyzed because of 7 strokes plus stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Wow. She says, so I don't know if I have long to live, but I'm still doing the good fight and using the very techniques that the director of the Institute and other scientists had applied in guided chemotherapy back then. But she says, I want to get this off my chest. This has been bothering me. She said, we never sent a single one of your studies out for peer review publication because of the biases of the existing scientists. And I was completely disheartened when they chose not to send out the results that we, our own medical doctors and nurses, without your input, except we were using your AIDS protocol. And 10 out of 10 patients who had full-blown AIDS, they had pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, Kaposi's sarcoma, and using your protocols without your input, you never met the patients, we cured everyone over a 4-year period. Now that should have made headline news, and we killed it. We never submitted it for publication because of fear that if we did, we wouldn't get any more big pharma financing. I've lived with that my whole adult life. I just want to, before I pass, I want to share that with you. She could barely talk, and therefore I'm having to ask her questions. That's why the form that we're taking. Now in 5 minutes, BAI will cut away for the news. By the way, I also want to thank all the runners who came out. I want to thank all of you who came up to Kingston. I promise I will never do another anything in Kingston. Not there's anything wrong with it, but it's a long trek up there. You know, in the future, it'll be in New York City, because then a lot more people who don't have public transportation easily available or could afford public transportation can come. That's my word to you. But I want to thank everyone who came. I posted my lecture for those who couldn't be there up on GaryNoll.com. So go to lectures and you'll see the Make America Healthy Again. All right? So getting our health back. Now let's go to this clip. And again, you're hearing a woman who couldn't type, barely talk. And so she asked me to ask her the question. She had to answer yes or no. Let's go to the clip, please.
Okay. He wrote a major textbook on chemotherapy, on how chemotherapy was used in the treatment of cancer.
Yes.
I think it was Guided Chemotherapy was the title?
Guided, yeah.
Guided Chemotherapy. And that he had many inventions in his medical career.
Oh, yes. That was never a dull moment with inventions.
He also invented Revi oil.
Revoil.
He invented the oil.
Yeah.
And that is what allowed him to fund the creation of the Institute of Biology. He had a lot of America's brightest scientists who worked at the Institute over the years, correct?
Yes.
You have been in communication over the last 53 years with many prominent scientists around the world for the research that you were doing with the doctor on cancer, pain, and other conditions.
Yeah, we worked very, very close.
Okay. And in 1970, I was brought into the Institute as a young junior scientist at the recommendation of Dr. Lawrence Lachan, and my interest in health and aging, even though I was a young person in my 20s, inspired Dr. Revisi because of his interest to allow me to have my own laboratory up on the third floor doing research on aging.
Yeah. And he always liked you very much because of your curiosity in science. You are extremely, extremely devoted and curious in science.
And I would meet with him at least once a week in the morning when I would leave the Institute when I worked overnight, go to his Park Avenue apartment and go over the research that I was doing. He was always interested in that research.
Yes.
But specific to what we're suggesting, over those 33 years full-time at the Institute and additional 5 years after, so 38 years total association with the Institute, I also was doing work, and you came over on AIDS and other conditions at my own center at 72nd and Broadway called the Tri-State Healing Center. You visited it many times.
Oh, yeah.
You worked almost 7 days a week. Is that correct, every day of the year?
Well, when you are young, you can do it. Now it will be more difficult, but when you are young, you can do it like you used to do.
Yeah, I was there all Man, when I look back, was I stupid.
You never slept.
I know I didn't sleep. I'd work all day and then go over there and work
all night, go home and do the studies.
I completed 100...
Those are the good days, Gary.
It's true that I completed 165 major clinical scientific studies at the Institute.
Yeah. Yes.
And and one of those studies, and there's 2 points that you and I discussed last night. One of them was that when you came over to the Tri-State Healing Center on one occasion and you spent hours there with the staff, the medical staff, and the patients, you saw we were getting remarkable results that you had not seen anywhere else with people with AIDS, right?
Yes.
And so you asked, could you have the protocol to see if you could duplicate the results without my direct intervention, just providing the protocol with your own medical doctors? And so I said, yes, I gave you the protocol. You set up an independent study using the exact protocol, nothing more, nothing less, a non-toxic, non-invasive, high-dose vitamin C drips, glutathione, et cetera. And with 10 individuals who all had full-blown AIDS at the Institute, over a period of 4 years, all of those people seroconverted to normal from HIV positive, negative, and all their opportunities to infection were gone. They were completely cured and natural. Is that correct or not?
Yeah, it's correct. And I remember very, very, that was a gentleman that he was part of your study and he was still alive a long time after all this AIDS was a little bit under control.
Yeah, you ran into another person in about 10 years ago who was part of that study and still alive and well.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Okay, now, was it also true, and I realize this is a little painful, and that's why you wanted to get this off your chest, that during all those decades, when I would do the original research upstairs in the laboratory, and I had no assistance, I did it myself, sometimes Dr. Berman would help confirm. I would have him say, Vic, see if my results are correct, and he would do that I would submit the outcome for peer review consideration and just kept going on with my work. But those results were never submitted for peer review because some of the people, senior scientists, felt that if my work were to get published, it might interfere with the funding from Big Pharma and the Pratt family, Pratt Whitney. Yeah, the airplane people were big supporters. And so it was just quietly never submitted. Is that correct?
That I know, yeah.
Okay.
There were a lot of people that they're worse than is today, probably, when the AIDS start, and a lot of people that they didn't believe in what they see, and it's so much politics, it's scaring when you think about.
Well, I was not liked or respected by any of the mainstream scientists there. They didn't understand my work.
They don't understand, and they lose because what you did was beautiful, related, and was beautiful. Even now, some people are still. I don't know now how many they are alive, but there were a lot of people that they were alive.
Because of my research and my clinical applications.
Yeah, of course, and you were there with them. Talking and explaining and...
At the monthly meetings of all the different departments, I would explain the outcome of my research and answer their questions. But these are people who did not believe that healthy lifestyle and behavior modification could change anything. They believed in the medication approach. So my work was simply rejected out of hand, not because it wasn't true and accurate and reproducible, but because of their own biases and political and limited views. Would you say
what
that's accurate?
What else is new today? Tell me. What else is new? The same story. Look how many things it's happening every day in science. The same thing.
Same thing today is then happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's part of an interview. I just want to get that out there for those of you who think that because it was 50 years ago, actually 53 years ago, when I was a young scientist, that somehow we were more idealistic. If you came up with a truth that was documented, provable, that other people could test it and see for themselves, that would then help realign the paradigm. No, not a single article I did in 168 studies with positive results. In fact, I came up with the first study on modified fasting, increasing the life of rats by 22%, 7 years before Dr. Roy Warford came up with the same results using the same protocols at UCLA. His got published, mine didn't. So we have built-in biases everywhere. And we've had them all along. So these are, unfortunately, this is the way human nature evolved when it was in a highly competitive, let's all go for the gold ring mindset. Did they want to help people? Yes. Did they have high levels of intelligence? Yes. But were they looking at a moral equation of shouldn't we work towards what is best, not simply what is best for me and the outcome? And there's the problem. Just want to share that with you. We can't take calls now. We're out of time. But again, I want to thank you all for listening and sharing and play it forward. Pass it on. Now, Utrice Lead. Have a nice day, everyone.